This episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast goes out to Ryan Bolstad,
Scott Garvin,
and Matthew Salisbury. You can join these super fans and a growing community of patrons over at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Get early access to shows, original art, behind-the-scenes look at what goes on at Major Spoilers, and more exclusive content like you've never seen before. Thank you to all of our current patrons, and we can't wait for the new ones to join right now, today. What are you waiting for? Patreon.com/majorspoilers.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, three nerds walk into a podcast to talk about four kids walk into a bank. The Wheel of News spins comics, games, and that big name trailer. More old school comedy with a kick butt poll of the week, plus Archie, Red Sonja, and a whole lot more. Another plane, another train, another Venom on the brain, another show, another night, another Major Spoilers Podcast on the air. Why you gotta bust my rhymes?
Welcome to issue 776 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for downloading and checking us out this week. So good to have you all. Ashley had to run to an audition.
Had to do a thing.
She had to do a thing, which is all cool. So she won't be here with us, but Matthew is here. Rodrigo is here. And most importantly, you, our dear listener.
Once again,
this week. And we're so happy to have you here because we had a lot to talk about, including four kids walk into a bank.
Mm-hmm.
I know Ashley had talked about a couple of issues of this before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I reviewed the first issue of a while ago. Mm-hmm.
I kind of dig this, but more on that later. But first, let us talk some news. Rodrigo Vampire the Masquerade is getting a fifth edition.
What?
But the first Venom trailer is also here. And the Fantastic Four return. Let's spin that wheel of destiny. Let's see where it lands. Oh, Fantastic Four return. That's a couple weeks old story. Vampire the Masquerade only appeals to Rodrigo and a select few. The first Venom trailer is here, and man, are people upset. Man, are people upset. Rodrigo, you had a chance to check out this trailer. What were your initial thoughts after seeing this Venom trailer?
So my very first thought when I saw this trailer was like, oh, good. Jenny Slate is in this.
Me too.
Yeah, because who doesn't love Marcel the Shell?
Jenny Slate does.
Yeah. Jenny Slate is great. She used to be on SNL. She was
got fired for throwing an F-bomb.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. But yeah, she's great. She's the sheep in Zootopia. So that was my first thought. Of course, my second thought was, man, they are going all in on Symbiote.
Yes. That's what so many people a lot of people are complaining about that.
You do a Venom movie, it's going to come up. The word, apparently, Symbiote is going to come up. And I know that both ways of saying it are fine, but I've always said Symbiote.
Yes.
Probably. Okay. Because I used to watch the 90s cartoon, and mm-hmm. that's where I learned the word from, and that's how they said it. Mm-hmm. Just like all of us who watched Batman, the animated series, say Ra's al Ghul, because that's how they said it.
Right.
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 I do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Me too. That's how I say it too. But I can understand. A lot of people are upset, and actually some of the comments that people are saying about Symbiote mm-hmm. are borderline becoming racist comments at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And it's that stuff needs to be knocked off like right away. If you want to make fun of someone's pronunciation, that's fine, but make sure that the pronunciation that's being used is being used correctly, which I believe it is, because you can pronounce it either way.
Actually, symbiote is not a real word.
Yeah. So in
it
this
is
case,
not a thing that exists.
But see, the Marvel fans are like, but that's how they say it in all the Marvel books, and that's canon, so therefore they have to say it that way. I don't think they have to do anything. And this kind of brings up a conversation that I had with one of our fans today on Twitter. He kind of got mad at me because he started off by saying, this kind of looks like poor, this looks really poor for modern CGI, and that's taking into account justification and skepticism that Sony can actually create a decent comic book movie. And I said, well, wait a minute. I guess we all know what an alien symbiote looks like. So I guess maybe you're right on that. But personally, I think that going off on poor CGI is kind of a weak sauce argument in this day and age. Because I looked at the stills of this. This is right on as far as what modern CGI is. Maybe it's not a look or a design of the Venom creature that people like, but it is spot on for what it's supposed to be rendered as.
Venom has always looked gross. I don't see the difference.
Yeah. And so I don't know that either, but as we went to go on, he made the comment that, well, we got into a conversation about, Sony doesn't care if this movie is faithful to the comics because it's not creating a movie for comic fans. It's creating a movie for moviegoers. And there are a lot more moviegoers in the world than there are comic book readers, especially Marvel comic book readers. And so that, I think, is kind of telling that this doesn't have to be for comic book people. This is for moviegoers.
Yeah, that's why some Marvel movies are so successful. Like, you know, nobody was like, hey, wait a minute. This, like, we can't have Iron Man go after people that are using his technology if they're not dressed like a manta ray. Like, they just made that movie and took parts of Iron Man that were good, and they used, you know, parts of the Armor Wars and parts of Demon in a Bottle and parts of all these other storylines and cobbled them together into the Iron Man movies. And they did it with a cinematic take, with this idea of, like, let's take all this stuff and do it this way. It's like, it doesn't have to be loyal to the comics. For one, in this, Eddie Brock appears to be a competent reporter. You know, like, that's the very first thing that doesn't square up with the comics.
Right, right. And then a lot of people are questioning.
Like, and that's fine, because you kind of need that for him to be a protagonist.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's also the question of, does Spider-Man appear in this? It doesn't look like he does. And how can you have Venom without Spider-Man, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, they've said that you can have Venom without Spider-Man. They're like, this is separate and distinct.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? I mean, it's like, you guys remember when Supergirl first came out, the TV show, right? It's like, we went
a whole season and a half.
Yeah, without seeing just Superman.
Yeah, we saw his boots.
Yeah, he's mentioned in the very first episode, and I remember being disappointed by that. I knew it was coming, but I remember thinking, what would a world where Supergirl exists, but Superman doesn't look like, what would that story be? And they won't give it to me. And I was like, maybe Venom can. Maybe Venom can give us that story of, like, what does Venom do when he doesn't have Parker, kill or to be thrown under a bell or you know, a grand piano or whatever, however you get rid of Venom.
You know, beyond the CGI argument, which if people want to have that argument, that's fine. I mean, we watch Flash and Arrow and Black Lightning, and there's some really bad CGI in those TV shows.
Dodgy stuff.
But no, it's not dodgy. It's bad. It's like, it's like video game level stuff that you would expect higher of in a television show. But the reason why we forgive it is because we're invested in the story. And I think, we don't know the story, but I kind of dig the horror, psycho horror that's going on. The vibe that we get in this trailer is like this psycho horror, and I kind of dig that.
Venom, I think, relates well and really lends itself to a gross body horror kind of story, because Venom is a gross character who, in 1994, his catchphrase for his action figure was, "I want to eat your brain." I mean, this is a gross, bulbous, shiny, yucky, alien thing you find under a rock, Venom. And I'd rather see that, because you have to differentiate Venom, especially in a world where there is no Spider-Man, from anyone else. If you're going to do this weird body horror, anti-hero kind of alien taking over your body, Kurt Russell take on the thing, but it makes you a superhero, you kind of have to embrace that. And I'm really grossed out at how moist his eyeballs look.
I know, right? It's really creepy.
It's great. It's great. Yeah,
it is.
Like, it is super yucky, and it's like right up Rodrigo's alley.
Yeah. And And that's good because they're just skipping right past it, right? They're just like, hey, you know, when like Venom was like a villain and he was all about killing Spider-Man and then he kind of becomes an anti-hero and then a full-on hero. They're just like, forget all that stuff. We're just going to skip straight to where we want Venom to live, which is anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there are bad people and you're going to be badder at them, Venom. It's like, yep. That's fine.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's just go there. Let's just go live there.
Well, and it seems like there is this agreement or battle from the trailer that Eddie Brock, played by Tom Hardy, is basically like, look, I'll let you kill people if we only kill bad guys. And so there's this moral dilemma that he's having to, do I unleash this monster? Do I not unleash this monster? Et cetera, et cetera. I know it's just a trailer and we're not getting the whole picture. That'll come with the second trailer, right? Because the first one, China kind of teases us into some of the elements and some of the big surprise stuff. And then the main trailer kind of reveals the entire story. That's the one that'll come out like a couple of months before the movie arrives in screens. But I don't know. I kind of like what I see here. And if people don't like it, I guess the good thing, the best thing that I can say is you don't have to go see it.
Yeah, that's I really wasn't like, oh, hell, because I used to love Venom in the 90s, you know, which was like primetime Venom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I watch this and I'm like, this is good. This is solid. Like, this is a good take on Venom. This is a good place for Venom to be there. And it's all about the themes that you see on screen. It's dark, it's scary, it's ugly, and it's like, so's Venom. So it all kind of works out.
Mm-hmm,
like, I don't really need this to be prettier or not look so gross or whatever. You know, I think it's doing well.
So there's one thing in this conversation that I had with this person, and I didn't intend it to be an argument. I think I was off on a bad foot with him. But he did say this one line that I agree with. But I want to get your guys' reaction to this before I say why I agree with this and also why it may be problematic. He says, to sum my problems up in a single line, Marvel makes superhero movies. The other studios make movies that use superheroes. And I said, I can agree with that statement. Do you guys have any reaction?
I'm not to that? Sure what that means.
I entirely disagree with that statement.
Marvel makes superhero movies. The other studios make movies that use superheroes.
But Marvel's superhero movies aren't actually superhero stories.
Yeah, that's actually backwards. Other studios fail at making superhero movies because they keep trying to make superhero movies. Right. They keep trying to make either like either Tim Burton's Batman or like the 1970 Superman. And it just does not work out.
One of the examples that he uses is he has no interest in seeing the New Mutants. Because it just looks like any ordinary horror movie that they're trying to jam superheroes into or comic book characters into. And he's not interested in a psychological horror story if they're trying to force Venom into it. He wants to see superhero movies. Here's my problem with his statement, though. While I can agree with him, here's the problem. If people only look at Marvel as a superhero movie studio, what happens when people are finally tired of the genre? That means Marvel is in trouble. And that means Disney is in trouble. And I don't think Disney would buy Marvel if at some point it was going to be a liability for the studio.
Sure they would. I mean, they do it all the time. But the thing about the statement, Marvel makes superhero movies, that bothers me is that the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies have literally done everything they can to negate the comic book superhero.
Right. I mean, we can look at Thor Ragnarok and the Guardians of the Galaxies are perfect examples of this.
You look at the first Iron Man, you look at the first Thor, you look at Captain America, the first Avenger. They have done everything in their power. Oh, Winter Soldier is a terrible movie. Don't ever look at that.
Winter Soldier is a great movie because it's exactly what I think Rodrigo is going for here is it's telling a 3 Days of the Condor story with superheroes in it.
And that's the fact that you guys really disagree on that is actually a great example of why structurally that really works, right? It's like Matthew and Steven are both high-fiving each other over The Great Escape, which is Captain America, the first Avenger, right. And then not so much on like, you know, like 70s, like spy stuff.
The conversation with bionic arms.
Right, exactly. So that is the strength of Marvel movies. And this... The reason why Deadpool was successful is because, you know, and everybody was like, what is this brand new formula? all the formula is you just get really close to the comic book and say, "What are you trying to tell me, comic?" Like, you have to take the essence out of that and then not worry about the tights, not worry about the special mm-hmm. effects, mm-hmm. not worry about that stuff, and just say, what is this comic about? Or what can we make this story about?
Yep.
And it's like, if it's like, if you look at Thor, it's like, you know, in the first Avengers movie, Iron Man makes fun of him and says it's Shakespeare in the Park. The first Thor movie kind of is Shakespeare in the Park.
Yep.
Thor mm-hmm. Ragnarok is not mm-hmm. that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows the strength of being like, where do we want to go with these characters? And let's just go there and not worry about, is this still a superhero movie?
Or is it a comic book movie?
Right. But that's the thing. Neither superhero movie nor comic book movie is truly a genre. It doesn't really tell you about the movie you're going to see, because in the truest sense, if you say to me, name three superhero movies, and if I say to you, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, 66 Batman, and a Tim Burton Batman, those are three superhero comic book movies. Darkman, tonally, yep. and what they're trying to say and how they're trying to do it are completely mm-hmm. different. Saying it's a superhero movie doesn't tell me what I'm going to see.
And I think that's the why, as Rodrigo said, Deadpool works so well because it turned into this raunchy comedy, and why mm-hmm. Logan works so well because it is a Western at its core.
You know what Deadpool reminded me of more than anything else when I saw it the first time?
Porky's?
No. Airplane.
Mm, sure.
The ZAZ parody mm-hmm. movies mm-hmm. that deadpan take everything that you saw in Airport 77, everything that you saw in the Towering Inferno, and said, okay, we're going to take this and we're going to play it so over the top that it comes back around to ridiculous and funny. That's what Deadpool is. It's a Zucker Abraham Zucker Marvel Cinematic Universe. I know it's a Fox, but you know what I'm saying. A movie set in that universe.
Yeah. I guess
that is why people are like, oh, this is amazing. This is brand new and different. And mm-hmm. I'm like, no, 1977, you guys.
Well, and so I guess that's why I don't understand why people are so hating on Venom. And I think that this person that I had a conversation with on Twitter and I got it hashed out to why he was so lukewarm on this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if you can tell a fantastic story that has superhero characters in it, or costume characters, or anti-heroes, or whatever they may be, mm-hmm. I think that just makes it more interesting than, hey, let's tell a true comic book story, because we've already done that.
Well, I mean, why do people not like this trailer or whatever?
So it really goes from the weak sauce argument of, this looks like crappy CGI, which it really doesn't,
right,
to, mm-hmm. hey, people can't pronounce symbiote right, to, hey, yeah. where's Spider-Man in this? This is automatically going to suck. To, oh, this is a Sony movie, and Sony's never been able to do a movie right, so therefore it's insta-fail.
Yeah.
See, people those, are just...
Yeah, those are difficult those arguments, are I think, to back up. Especially considering that, you know, Sony had, you know, 2.5 very successful Spider-Man movies.
Yes.
You know, like, Sony has done superheroes before, and they've done them right. You know, Matthew's right. That Spider-Man movie... That Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie is a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
up and down, left to right, it is a superhero movie. And it is glorious in how joyous it is about being a superhero movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of reasons not to like this trailer. Like, again, the Winter Soldier example is a great example. It's like, it's mm-hmm. you look at this trailer and you're like, I don't want to see this, like, dark, gritty, murderous superhero thing. It's like... Mm-hmm. Totally legit. If that's not what you're into,
this
like
is
I don't
want to
see a super yucky superhero. That's cool too. It's like I just don't like. I don't like that Bane is now.
that's not Venom.
That Bane is now Carnage.
You're allowed to cross universes. Green Lantern is Deadpool. I feel like I'm not going to watch this movie. I don't necessarily want to see this movie. I have no love for Venom, but I feel like it's a step in the right direction because. Superhero movie doesn't mean anything. And until you can make me, you know, the conversation with a superhero, until you can make me Get Out with a superhero, if you can make me Weird Al Yankovic's UHF with a superhero movie or a superhero character in it, that's the point, I feel, that the superhero genre or the idea of a comic book movie or the idea of a superhero movie is really going to be kind of completely and utterly streamlined to the point, you know, we saw this with 50s Westerns. They were all of a piece. And eventually you got to that weird place where they were making things like A Fistful of Dollars. They were making, you know, Cowboys in Space, or as we call it, Star Wars. You make those films and you take them different places, but they're still kind of the same thing. And they have those characters in them. That's a good thing to me.
Well, and
if this is going to be some weird, freaky alien, you know, mix up of The Thing and Taxi Driver, I'm on board for that, because that means that I'm not going to have to watch another 54 freaking Batman origin movies. We know they shoot the Waynes, you guys. Changing the person who shoots the Waynes does not make it a different movie. You suck. Sorry,
I think that's why that's why I'm kind of keen on this Han Solo movie, because it doesn't feel like a quote unquote Star Wars movie. It feels like a heist movie with Star Wars characters in it.
Oh man, I saw a complete tangent. So there's this, I want to say like Denny's commercial.
Okay.
Where they're, I'll bring it back.
Okay.
Where they are selling, like along with a meal, these like Solo Star Wars movie trading cards. And so they have this little kid Han Solo, this little kid Lando, and a bunch of aliens around them. And the first time I saw that, I for reals thought that was part of the movie. And it's like these like 10-year-old Han and Lando. And I was like, oh man, this movie's going pretty deep. And it turns out it was just an ad for like Denny's or something.
I was like, oh man,
now I'm kind of disappointed.
Yeah.
10-year-old Han.
I guess the thing is, here's what I would like to see. If people want to put down a trailer or movie or whatever.
It's a trailer, dude.
Well, even if they go and see this movie and they want to put it down, whatever it may be, people want to put down Wonder Woman. That's fine. But I hope that they just have super solid arguments and facts to back up their arguments, I guess is what I'm getting down to.
I mean,
having a vague diss on something, you know, doesn't hold water with me. If you're going to say, oh, this movie's going to suck because it doesn't have Spider-Man in it. Well, why is Spider-Man so important? Tell me why.
Yeah.
That is such an important part for this movie to fail.
If you're prognosticating it, then yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
If you're like, well, this movie's going to be bad because, you know, clearly they're not doing their due diligence with the character. They're doing unearned things because there's no Spider-Man and blah, blah, blah. Sure. All right. That's an argument. That's fair. Mm-hmm. I think if you go see the movie and you're just like, well, I just kind of in general didn't like it, I think that's also fair.
I
think you don't need to do a huge backup for, you know what, I just kind of really wasn't feeling these, four distinct storylines that turned out to be The Last Jedi, not to project or anything.
I would agree with you. I mean, here's the thing. Do I want to see Venom? Yeah, I kind of want to see Venom. Am I going to get to see Venom? Probably when it arrives on home video, just like this weekend. I'm not going to be able to see The Avengers as much as I want to see The Avengers. I'm not going to get to see it the first weekend. I wanted to see Ready Player One. Haven't had a chance to go see Ready Player One. Won't get to see it until it arrives on home video. So it's not going to hurt my feelings one way or another. The movie studio is going to end up eventually getting my money.
All right.
If I decide not to watch it, then that's fine too. Yeah, you're the movie pass guy, right?
So I'm like on a clock. I'm like, how much I'm trying to get more value out of this. I'm already paying for this. Show me more movies.
I'm trying to run this company out of debt into debt as quickly as I can.
Yeah. We all know this isn't going to last. I need to run out of, like, just run this into the ground.
Right. And it is important to note that you can dislike and not want to see a movie for whatever reason you want. But I think the problem that we run into, there are still people who come and show up and yell at me that Wonder Woman is a colossal flop. And I'm like, well, how does that even work? And apparently it wasn't as big a hit as they thought they were told that it should have been.
Oh.
And since they decided that the film was going to be bad, clearly the fact that it underperformed based on something that they thought they heard means that the movie was bad and it didn't have a big enough audience, which
it sucks because it's put out by DC.
That's a Dungeons and Genuas bull crap argument.
And that's what I'm trying to get across.
I'm a comic nerd. Comic nerd for like 40 years now. And if you're having a Marvel DC argument in the year 2018 as to why you don't want to see Wonder Woman or why Black Panther isn't as good as it could have been, then frankly, man, eat a bug. Just eat a big
bug. You can have DC versus Marvel stuff arguments, providing that you understand where you're coming from and why you're having that argument. That's why we have the poll of the week, right? It's there to have that argument, to have a discussion, and to find out more about other people. But the only way you're going to find out more about the other person or what their point of view is by having a meaningful discussion about that.
Bug.
Yeah.
Feel free to eat a bug. That's what I say.
Okay. Hey, speaking of eating bugs.
Yes.
We've got the Doodling Review podcast. Many people may not be familiar with this, I can tell, because it's got quite a few fewer listeners than the Major Spoilers podcast.
I tell Steven eat a bug regularly.
You really don't.
I don't.
And what I really tell Matthew is, Matthew, there's going to be 7 spiders that crawl into your sleep apnea hose tonight. You will be inhaling.
I'm not afraid of spiders. I'm afraid of wasps.
Oh, okay. Then that's why I never get the reaction that I get from him. Anyway, exactly. We do another podcast called the Doodling Review Podcast, where instead of just kind of giving a passing review on a single issue or a bunch of issues or a trade paperback, Matthew and I sit down and read a brand new comic book that is out this week. And then we discuss it, and we usually takes us 20, 30 minutes to get through a discussion. Sometimes less if there's really not a whole lot to say, if it's not really a good comic book. Sometimes we will argue, sometimes we will agree. But here's the thing. You, our listeners, get to pick which comic we review. For the longest time, Matthew and I just kind of talked back and forth about which things we wanted to review, and then Matthew wouldn't respond in time, so I would have to pick the book, et cetera, et cetera.
Steven would forget to send the email in the first place, and he'd still have to pick the book.
Letting our listeners choose what book we read. And how do we do that? Well, Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, sometimes Sunday or Monday, I will release a list of the new comics coming out this week. And then we ask our patrons at patreon.com/majorspoilers to vote on what comic they want us to read. And then whichever one gets the most votes, we'll review. This week, it's Dungeons and Dragons Evil at Baldur's Gate number 1.
Baldur.
Here's the thing.
Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, that's what I said. Baldur's Gate.
Baldur's Gate.
Classic.
Yes. Anyway. Evil at Baldur's Gate. That's what I said.
I know.
Here's the thing. You don't have to be a Major Spoilers patron to vote. You do have to have a Patreon account. You don't have to be a patron of Major Spoilers to vote. This is free and open to anyone that has a Patreon account. So we hope that you guys head over there and vote. Voting closes on Wednesday afternoon. So there's only a few days to get over there and suggest what thing that we are going to read. And then Matthew and I will read it and share our thoughts on the Doodling Review podcast. You can find the Doodling Review podcast at majorspoilers.com. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever fine podcast RSS feeds are served. Let us do some reviews. Matthew, you've got a book is this from last week, Red Sonja?
This is from next week.
Ah, next week. Okay. So
this is an advance review.
Make sure that it doesn't have, spoilers and stuff, because they do say to do that. Also, we need to, so this is releases on what day? May 2nd. May 2nd, 2018. We're going to try to put release dates in our show notes for you. So when you're looking, you know when these books are released.
Yeah.
Matthew, please. Red Sonja and Tarzan, number 1. This is a Gail Simone joint.
It is. Gail Simone and Walter Giovanni, who were the creative team on Clean Room, which is terrifying, from Dynamite Entertainment, Red Sonja, Tarzan. And you may say to yourself, how does this happen? Tarzan is an adventure in the 1920s. And Red Sonja is in the Hyborian Age. What? And I say to you, that's a good question. Read the book. I want to tell you a story right here now. Steven is definitely the pulp hero guy at Major Spoilers. But I have my moments where I've dipped my toe into the pulp hero stuff. And I love me some Shadow. And I really love me some Avenger. And I can take or leave your Doc Savage. I love Green Hornet with a passion, but I've never had any positive feeling for Tarzan.
Because Tarzan really isn't. The reason why is Tarzan is like proto-pulp. Tarzan came out like 20 years before a lot of these other characters appeared. And that's why I think you may have a problem with not getting into Tarzan.
I don't know. I think it may just be the stories that I've seen. I mean, there was the Ron Ely movie, and then there was a Disney cartoon, and it had Rosie O'Donnell in it. The Bo Derek movie was horrific. This comic, Red Sonja Tarzan number one, is the first time in my 47 years on planet Earth that I have said, hell yeah, Tarzan, because this story involves a villain, an evil, evil gentleman who is very, very evil, but not very gentle, whose name is Isondul, who somehow manages to be both a thorn in the side of Red Sonja and a thorn in the side of John Lord Greystoke. And the mechanics of how are not important. Read the book. But it has a really wonderful couple of scenes in it. It has, of course, Gail Simone has worked on Red Sonja before and really redefined Red Sonja in comics for me. There's a really great Red Sonja moment where she's in a bad mood and stalks into town. And she walks in and she sits down and demands two bottles of booze and somebody heat her dagger in the fire until it's red hot. And I'm like, wait, what? And then, of course, the thing that happens next makes perfect sense. But there is a moment in this issue where Tarzan, Lord Greystoke, shows up. He is going, you know, he's going face to face with the evil villainy guy, and the evil villainy guy is evil and villainy. And Tarzan stands up, and Tarzan does something that I never expected Tarzan to do. He looks the man right in the eye and says, unless you want me for an enemy. And of course, again, there's stuff around this. I don't want to spoil it because it's out on the 2nd of May. But oh my word, ladies and gentlemen, this is a story that makes you really understand what the heart of a Gail Simone Tarzan is, and really gives you that Gail Simone Red Sonja that I've kind of known and loved for about the last 3 or 4 years. And manages to make them both work and to make them both awesome and to make the fact that they shouldn't, they couldn't, they probably aren't supposed to have ever interacted with one another. And that however this story is going to happen is going to involve something really weird and freaky work. It makes 24 pages of these two characters really solid. It makes both of them understandable. And again, you know, most of the Tarzan that I've read in terms of comics is stuff from the 1970s, which was drawn by Joe Kubert.
Yeah.
And Kubert is a hard act to follow. Giovanni manages to pull it off. There's a scene in here where Tarzan is wearing a three-piece suit and he becomes angered and he becomes tired of his three-piece suit. And he gives the shout of Kriga Bundalo and rips away his shirt and his jacket to reveal, oh yeah, the Tarzan costume, which is to say, I'm a shirtless man going rar. But oh man, it's pretty. It's a pretty book. It is a well-written book. And it is a book that they don't necessarily lay out everything for you, but you can see in this issue the hows and the whys of how these two characters can interact. And moreover, you can see the point of having them do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like this is going to be another one of those weird Dynamite crossovers where you're like, how do these characters even meet? But when you're done, it's going to really emphasize what's great about each of these characters. So I came in with no particular love for Tarzan and an affection for Gail Simone's Red Sonja, but not as a huge Red Sonja fan, and walked away giving this book 4 slices of meatloaf. This is a really, really good comic. You should check it out when it comes out next week.
All right, cool. So just for clarification, because I know I'm going to get an email about this, when I said Tarzan is a proto-pulp hero. And the reason I say this is because Tarzan did appear in a pulp magazine, his first appearance in 1912, right? Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago, over 100 years ago at this point.
Like 106.
And then that was turned into, of course, a book release 2 years later. The popularity of pulps was really more between the 20s and the 30s. That's when it was like the high point. So, yes, Tarzan technically a pulp character, but he's kind of in that early wave of pulp characters that you see.
I still count Zorro as a pulp character, and he's a good 30 years early and didn't really pulp so much as he pulped his pulp, you know.
Yeah,
that's from like 1909. So
yeah, and really pulp magazines go back to like 1896. Zorro, when did he appear? I want to say he appeared like 1918, something like that.
is when it was 1909.
No, 1919.
Looks like it's 1919. You're 1919 right, yeah.
is when he appeared. These, you know, when you look at pulp characters, you got to realize if you're going from 1896 to, you know, the 1950s, there was a high point. And for those that fall outside of that bell curve, that's why, and I honestly think those that fall outside of the bell curve are why people may not take to them as much as they might take that slice of The Shadow and Doc Savage and all those other guys.
I like me some Scarlet Pimpernel. I mean,
yeah, that's a book on. And way before that.
That's 1905, but even so, he invented the secret identity. I mean, how can you not love that?
The
first rich idiot with no day job.
Rodrigo, what do you have for us?
I have The Mainstream, number one.
Number one. I think this one
is anyone in the mainstream?
Say what?
Is anyone in the mainstream?
Yes. At least one person is in the mainstream. It is a cop. The Mainstream is a comic book that is put out by Zenescope, but I think there might be, it's like a creator owned thing.
It's a creator owned one that Zenescope is publishing.
Yeah. So so don't expect this to have any ties to any Zenescope proprietary things. So this is a story about a detective who has this strange ability to sort of, put information together or find things. It's kind of ambiguous, and he uses it in his detective work to sort of solve crimes and things like that. And pretty soon we see that his abilities may come from a sort of greater conspiracy, which might be tied to people from other dimensions coming into this world. I feel like this comic has a difficult road ahead of it, because we've seen a lot of multi-dimensional stuff in all sorts of media, right? Done in lots of different ways, from something like Fringe, where it's like, oh, here's this one other dimension that we're mostly going to be dealing with, spoiler alert, to something like Rick and Morty, which, you know, it's bread and butter is going to other dimensions and wacky things that happen, right? It's always interesting to be like, okay, so multiple dimensions, dimensional conspiracy. Okay, what are you doing that's different? And it's really kind of not that much. That's probably the thing that was sort of disappointing about this, is like it was hard to get a hold from this very first issue on what it is about this that's going to make it different from The One or from, you know, any sort of like multi like version of yourself type story. Probably the biggest thing is the visuals of the comic. I think that comics in the 90s and early 2000s, especially in the early 2000s, really started going nuts with digital effects. And that has really come down a lot, but the Mainstream uses digital effects pretty well in general. When our protagonist senses some sort of discrepancy or that something's amiss, things kind of jitter, and it's clear that it's like a digital jitter effect that was added to things. Like there's like a drawing of a table and then the table is like digitally jittered. That or Tony Moy is just like a cut above as far as artistry, and he can just draw something that looks a lot like a digital effect. I guess that could be it. But the way that things are sort of kind of blurred together really kind of shows that, at least in the coloring, there's some sort of like digital based kind of trickery there, which is good. I mean, it looks interesting. It looks good. There are also some interesting sort of things that they do. Just visually, the main character looks at something and he starts doing his like buzzing, jittering thing. But like somebody's still talking to him. So behind him, the word balloons are blurry. Like, first off, they're cropped by his, like, they are literally behind him. The word balloons exist in space behind him. They're cropped by his body and his face, and also they're blurry. And that is, I don't know if other comics have done this before. I don't recall anything like that. It's possible that they have, but I felt it was a very good way of showing somebody who's not paying attention to a conversation, right? It's a very strong visual way of being like, this guy's not paying attention, or he's occupied with something else. You know, the designs are interesting. There's a lot of like hyper tech immediately in this. So visually the comic is very interesting, but I was really struggling to find something to latch on to more than just that, just on the way the comic looked. And I kind of didn't find it. It's not bad. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just not particularly, it's not really grabbing me as far as something new to do with this genre. And, you know, it doesn't have to be. I was just kind of looking for that. So I'm going to give it 2.5 slices of meatloaf. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this comic. It was an enjoyable read, and you know, I might pick up the next issue just to see if it kind of takes me in a direction that I like a little bit more.
Cool. Thank you for that, Rodrigo. This week, Archie number 30 arrives from writer Mark Waid and Ian Flynn, with art by Audrey Mock, with colors by Kelly Fitzpatrick and letters by Jack Morelli. It is the night of the big dance. And Archie's got his guitar back from last issue, if you remember, I was talking about it on this show. But he's nervous because the rest of his band isn't going to show up. What's going to happen? Oh, my. Maybe there's another band in Riverdale. Maybe an all-girl band that can come and show up at the last minute.
Maybe with long tails and ears for hats.
I love the fact that Archie will break, especially at the beginning of a comic, will break the fourth wall and talk to the reader about how he's not nervous about the date and about the dance and everything's all fine and dandy. And he even shows a copy of the very first issue of Archie Comics to prove that he's come a long way in these last 30 issues. Archie's not the focus of this. Everyone else in Riverdale is. We get a wonderful, wonderful Moose and Midge hookup in this issue, where a girl, he's out on his date with another girl, and she's just totally like, oh, you are like the most boring person in the world. And she stomps off. And of course, Midge is working the restaurant and comes to find out that they both really, really dig each other. And so we get to see that romance blossom, and we get to see happy yay. They're both going to go to the dance. So she's going to quit, ditch work and go with Moose to the ball. We get to see, of course, Reggie still being the worst in the worst way. Like, his dad wants to beat the crud out of him, but doesn't. And it's beautifully written. Yes, Josie and the Pussycats will be making an appearance in the next issue. Maybe. And I say maybe. I mean, Mr. Witherby even gets a great moment where we get to see Mr. Witherby through the ages of proms, from when he was a student all the way to today. Just a wonderful, just brilliant. But if you remember the last time I talked about Archie number 29, the Blossom's father had broken out of jail. Eddie Shears. We see him in the last panel dressed as a security guard. And the title of the next issue is Hostage Situation. I don't know what's going to happen, but I will just say this. And I said this earlier today on Twitter. Archie is that hidden gem that more people need to be reading. Since the very first issue, Mark Waid has been knocking it out of the park from Betty being involved in the car crash and losing the use of her legs for a while. As she, apparently in this issue, she's trying to walk without crutches and she's trying to go into the dance on her own 2 feet with Veronica, to Reggie being thrown in jail, to the kiss incident and the breakup of Betty and Archie and Archie and Veronica. This is a fantastic series. And maybe when we look back at the career of Mark Waid, we'll probably put Kingdom Come up there at number one and his run on the Flash at number two. And I have a big feeling that his run on Archie will be right up there in the top five. That is how good this series is. The art by Audrey Mock is fantastic. I love it. I want to read this again and again and again. If there's one comic that you buy this week, I think it should be Archie number 30. This is really that good of a comic. A great story, great art. It draws you in, gives you those moments that make you go, wee, or squeak, or whatever that you say when you're excited when romance is blossoming. This isn't Riverdale. This is not your TV series Riverdale.
This so it's
is
good?
Really good. This is really okay. Good. This is 5 out of 5 slices of meatloaf good. And I really encourage you guys to rush out and buy Archie number 30. It is great. Ah, more people need to be reading this. In fact, I think if we can get half of our listeners, we would see this comic bump up to be in the top 20 easily next month. Archie number 30 from Archie Comics. Go out and pick it up today. It's that good. It's a shame that Ashley is not here this week. Because after our Three Stooges discussion, she made the comment, oh, I can talk for days about the Marx Brothers. So knowing that she was going to be out for a couple of weeks on her trips to conventions and other places, I purposefully delayed Who Is Your Favorite Marx Brother until this week when I knew she was going to be here. And then at the last minute, she had to bail for good reason.
Sure.
So I guess without Ashley here, I don't know if any of us can answer who the question of who is your favorite Marx Brother. Can you, Matthew?
Yes.
Okay, who might it be?
It's actually weird because the Marx Brothers is one of the, not necessarily a blind spot, but one of the things that I've only been aware of through osmosis.
Through Zach on film?
To some degree. We saw, you know, Marx Brothers film strips or film loops film when strips. I was in school. Yeah, they would come and they would play them. In like, you know, school days when they're like, we need to kill some time.
Yeah.
We'd see Laurel and Hardy and we'd see the Marx Brothers and we'd see the Three Stooges. But for me, and this feels unusual because I'm not usually the guy who gravitates towards the character in question. To me, it's always going to be Groucho. And I think that may be because, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that Harpo Marx is hysterical. I think that that man is a damn genius. What he does with the limitations of what his character is. And even if you take into account the fact that, you know, the whole Chico routine is kind of reminiscent of fake Rigo. And he probably came forward in time and stole that from me and then went back.
I'm sure
in time.
That's what it is.
Yeah, the Marx Brothers had a time machine. You didn't know that?
I did watch the movie, Marx Brothers Back in Time.
Right, that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. But I think it's Groucho, partly because most of what I knew about the Marx Brothers, other than just their films, was Groucho on You Bet Your Life when I was a kid.
Mm.
And just the speed of the things that he said, and whether or not they were written beforehand, I don't know, but it always felt like he was just throwing these things off the cuff. And the probably apocryphal story about the woman who had 14 children. And he's like, lady, I love my cigar, but I take it out of my mouth once in a while. Just that, you know, that character where weird things happen and people are like, oh, how can you do this? And he's like, I don't know. How did he even get my pajamas in the first place? I kind of love that. I love that character. And I love the fact that his entire routine was basically Bugs Bunny before Bugs Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sort of appeals to me. So it's always going to be Groucho for me.
All right. Rodrigo, what about you?
Yeah, I'll go with Groucho. I'm also not very familiar with the Marx Brothers. I've seen a few things, but you know, obviously I feel like Chico is underrated because he's kind of the straight man a lot of the time. You know, it's like without him, Harpo and Groucho don't get to do their thing as much. And of course, I pretty much everything that I've seen, Zeppo is like not even in the group. Like he's like another character in it, but he's not even
the straight man. He's the straight man of the group.
Yeah, so, he's actually almost bland.
Yeah,
by design, so, certainly.
Yeah, I remember we watched Duck Soup, and then all of a sudden this guy who's like the assistant to like the dictator guy or whatever comes out and starts singing with them, and I'm like, what's that guy doing? And I was like, eventually I was like, oh, he's actually one of the Marx Brothers. How come he's not wearing a funny hat?
Right.
Or has like a weird face? You know,
he doesn't.
Yeah, and Gummo, I literally do not know.
Yeah, he's more like the business side of the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
I think he was in, he was like in the early vaudeville days before Zeppo was old enough to join. Mm-hmm. And so he was in there. And then when Zeppo became old enough to join, Gummo went off to go do like some business stuff, if I remember correctly. And then Zeppo became the straight man.
Essentially, he's Shemp without the coming back part.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the accountants are like, oh, definitely Gummo then.
Yeah, Gummo for sure.
But yeah, it's hard. I don't think any other than maybe Harpo, I don't think any of the other Marx Brothers have had the staying power that, you know, Groucho's shadow or like silhouette or like cartoonified face has had on pop culture.
Very true.
So I'll go with Groucho.
Here's the weird thing. I like Groucho. I love him for his one-liners. I just wish, you know, like in the movie scene, he needs to speak up a little bit more because a lot of his one-liners are lost in his mumblings. Chico, I would agree, is more like the Larry of the group if we're making a Three Stooges comparison. Where he's just like the hard worker and he does the stuff, but I'm sorry, that's Chico. And Harpo is the Harpo is the crazy of the group. He is the loose cannon that you never know what's going to happen, but he's the one that always comes out and in the movies has the most brilliant performances in all of the movies. That's why he gets to do the musical number, or, you know, play the harp, play the piano. He's the one that gets to do the mirror routine. He's, you know, just super, super brilliant. But for me, the Marx Brothers, again, really don't work if you don't have a straight man that's trying to keep it all together. And so I went with Zeppo. He's the love interest. He's the one that everyone is focusing the attention on the story of, hey, we've got to get the guy to marry the girl, or we've got the girl to go meet the guy. Zeppo is that guy. He's kind of the glue that holds a story together. Routines alone work really, really well. And a lot of the routines that you see the Marx Brothers do in their movies are literally lifted from their stage performances. And little set pieces are built around those performances. And those set pieces all include Zeppo. And so I went with Zeppo as my favorite of the Marx Brothers because he's the straight man. He's the glue that holds the story together. He's the guy. What's really surprising, though, is I figured it would be Groucho would be number one by the voter guess. And I figured that Harpo would be number two, which is right. I figured Chico would be number three. I figured it'd just be like one, two, three. Mm-hmm. And I figured there might even been some arguing between Harpo and Chico. I figured Gummo would get 0 votes, which he's at 0 votes.
He has 0 votes, yeah.
I was not expecting Zeppo to have as many votes as he does. He has more votes right now than Chico.
Do not underestimate the power of Joss Whedon. That is why Zeppo is getting the votes.
Why is that?
Because people remember that Joss Whedon episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer where Xander, who everybody loves, decided that he was the Zeppo.
Oh, and
he had to find a way for himself to belong.
Well, I missed that episode or don't remember that. But Zeppo's my choice, and he's actually at number three in this poll. Yeah,
he is, and Chico at number four, which is weird. The weird thing to me, and I think there may be also an aspect of not aging well in Chico's faux Italian accent thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. I mean, it really does become borderline bigotry.
Well, I mean, it definitely does feel like you're making fun of, you know, an entire class of people, or you're making fun of people who, you know, don't necessarily speak English as a primary language, which I think that you can see some cruelty in that. And You know, Harpo does look remarkably like when Professor Stein played Jesus in Godspell. So I do love that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's nice.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oof.
Only so here's some comments.
Groucho to have more than 55% of the vote too.
That's weird. if you're splitting that up among five people, it would be hard to have one person have as much as Groucho does. It's not surprising that he has that almost 60%. In the chats we have only their early Paramount films with Zeppo are truly great. So Zeppo, because Chico needed the money.
it's true, he did.
you bet your life it's Groucho. Yeah, Groucho had a much longer career after everyone else.
He did, yeah. He lasted into the late 70s, I want to say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he died at, what is it, 77, I want to say? He died at, like, a really old age.
Yeah, he was, like, 88 years old or something, because he was born before the turn of the century.
Yeah, he was born in 1890, died in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Plus, you know, I don't know if you guys ever read Cerebus.
Yes.
But if you read Cerebus, he's also Lord Julius, the leader of the entire country. Mm-hmm. And that almost kind of makes up for it, because you're just like, wow, that's nuts.
Listeners, head over to majorspoilers.com, cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. And I guarantee you next week, we're going to corner Ashley and we're going to have her share her favorite Marx brother. Yep.
Yep.
All right. Hey, this week, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know what my favorite line that from Groucho Marx is?
What is it?
He's interviewing, I want to say, Pedro Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, so Pedro Gonzalez is like, oh, we should go on the road together. We should have an act. And he's like, oh, yeah, what would you call it? And he's like, well, Pedro Gonzalez and Marx. And he's like, great. There's only two people on the show and I still get third billing.
That's funny. That is funny. This week we're taking a look at four kids walk into a bar, the trade paper or walk into a bank. Four kids walk into a bar and they're called Stephen and Matthew in college, freshmen in college.
How are ya?
Four kids walk into a bank. Rodrigo has reviewed the first issue before. I think Ashley has reviewed an issue or two, but this week we're reviewing the entire volume, which I think is what, 6 or 8 issues. It's over 200 pages of comics. The trade came out not too long ago from Black Mask Studios. And I got to see, I was not expecting. I don't know what I was expecting in this story. This came off as a super dark comedy that had moments where I was like, oh, I cannot believe they just did that in a comic. And how can they get away with this as in, right, you know, in a story? And it just had me rolling with laughter and then also had me crying with pain at what happened to some of these kids.
Yeah, this is one of those that if you tried to describe this plot, it would come across as feeling very cruel. It would come across as feeling, you know, because there, I don't know if you know this, but there's a point where our primary character, our protagonist, our heroine, sets a guy on fire.
Oh, yeah. I know, it's funny, right? Like,
you can't say these 12-year-old kids set a guy on fire, also blind a guy, and they're working on robbing a bank, but for a totally good reason, you guys.
Yeah, so the plot of this story is literally one day these four friends are hanging out and some bad guys show up at their house and they want to speak with the page, the main character's father. And it takes them an issue or so to figure out, but it turns out Paige's father was involved with these criminals. And the father feels like he owes them because they went to jail so that he could be out with his daughter as a single father. The mother has passed away, which also is kind of a bit point in this story. And her daughter is worried that dad's going to get involved in a bank robbery with these criminals and he's going to wind back up in jail and she's not going to have her father in her life. Mm-hmm. And so she comes up with this cockamamie plan with her friends that they're going to rob the bank before the robbers do so that her dad is safe.
Right. And the real turning point for me, because I started reading this and I'm like, what is this? Because it starts with a Dungeons and Dragons game.
Right.
Or a reasonable facsimile thereof. And then we get into this point. And the point where it immediately I felt like I had it is on like page 24 where they're there and the bad guys are there and everybody's talking and there's some tension. And then a full panel pops up that says, reminder, under no circumstances is it okay to wander into somebody's house uninvited and sucker punch a child in the face.
A girl in the face. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what happens. And I'm like, oh my God, this guy just wandered in and punched out an 11-year-old girl. And I'm like, what is this book about? And I really kind of like it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that finally sold me on the book, because I was kind of the same way with you, is when Paige is meeting with the bully in the schoolyard and mm-hmm. he's just calling her every name and they're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And mm-hmm. finally, Paige drops a your mama comment that I can't even repeat here because it is like that's coming out of a 12-year-old's mouth. Holy crap. And then there's a beat, a panel of silence. And then there is a, yeah, well, my mom didn't kill herself kind of thing too. And it's just like, holy crap, this book goes right for the throat
and starts beating the bejesus out of him.
Yeah. This book does not hold back, goes right to the throat and, drags you down with it, every step of the way.
Now, did anybody else feel like this takes place in England? Is that ever explicitly stated?
No, it's funny you should mention that. Go ahead, Rodrigo.
There are a few instances where, like, some of the word usage is, like, borderline English, it seems.
Yeah, but they're dealing with, like, regular cops and regular taxis and all those kinds of things. Here's the thing, Matthew. Just
American taxis.
Yeah, here's the thing. Yeah. As I'm reading this, I was like, oh, this would make an excellent movie if it was set in England. So I don't know what it about this. Maybe it's because we've all seen Lock, Stock, and Two Broken Barrels.
Yeah.
Lock, and Stock, the Italian, and Two Smoking Children.
The Italian Job and Snap.
Maybe that kind of vibe that's carried through here, but I kind of got this needs to be an English story. And it's not. It totally isn't.
I think that may be just another example of the influences showing through, because what I love so much about this is the point where you can recognize direct influences. You recognize the Han Solo dialogue. Yes.
Oh, everything's
from
fine
Star
here.
Wars.
How
are there's some like straight up comic references. One there's something that they call that's in the corner of Gray Malkin and Yancey.
Mm-hmm. There's weird references too. There's a reference to the painting The Great Wave at Kanagawa. Yep. I'm like, oh, somebody just spilled orange soda. But there's so much depth and weird resonance going on. At one point, you know, we mentioned that they accidentally blinded one of the bad guys.
No, not accidentally. The bad guy punched the girl and Berger shot a slingshot into the guy's eye.
Yes. And then the guy's making fun of Berger and Berger's like, nice eye patch, Polyphemus.
Oh yeah.
Damn.
That's a deep cut.
That is a deep cut. And then of course they have a whole discussion about being on the radio. Just say over once. Over. What's your call sign? My call sign is over, over. Over, 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 over. Yeah, now that I say it, it's confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. Burger's the worst. Also, I don't want to spoil the ending of this. So while we're talking about, you know, this being a comedy, it gets dark. There are places in this book where it's really, really dark and it's really, really disturbing. And the ending of this book is not the happy ending you think you're going to get.
The ending of this book is a heart punch. It is a tough book. And, you know, forgive my language if this gives us a tag. This is what Joe Lansdale refers to as a story that'll knock your dingus in the dirt, because it is mean-spirited and it does not hold back. And I like that. You know, I feel like it's a cliche sometimes to say that, oh, life is messy and awkward and dark and terrible things happen. But here, once you get into the story and they do what they're doing and you're like, well, clearly this is this weird Hollywood plot and it's going to have the Hollywood ending that I expect. Something's going to happen. She has that cool uncle who's a cop and he's going to step in and it's all going to be, you know, it's going to end fine with a freeze frame and everybody slapping each other on the back. And oh, no, 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 it does not.
So Rodrigo, you read this before Matthew and I did.
Right.
What's your overall reaction to this book now that I don't know if you continued to read it as the single issues came out, but what is your overall reaction to this book now that you've had a chance to get all the way through it?
Yeah. When I first read it, I thought it was really interesting, but also like just really not my thing. So I wasn't too keen to continue reading it. Now that I have read it, I'm glad that I did, because, you know, this book is doing a lot of interesting things, and it kind of creates its own little sort of things that you expect. Like, I think every issue starts out with sort of like an imagination scene,
right? Mm-hmm. Right,
in which the characters are discussing something or doing something. Mm-hmm.
Playing with toys or playing a video game. Yep. Or...
I think in the very last one, they have to cheat it ever so slightly, but it still works.
Yep.
So, you know, it's like this. It's hard to compare this to anything. You know, it's like, is this like Dog Day Afternoon, but with kids? No.
No, not
quite. Is this like a Wes Anderson movie gone wronger? No.
It's like a Wes Anderson, Quentin Tarantino mashup.
Joint production. Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, whoever did Lock Stock. What's his name? Married to Madonna for a while.
Guy Ritchie.
I guess. I mean, there isn't like, up until the very end, there isn't that sort of like nonsense action that you'd.
There's a lot of nonsense dialogue that goes back and forth, though.
Yes.
If we're going to call this a director, I can tell you who it is.
Who it is.
This is Steven Soderbergh.
That's what I was going to say.
Yep. This is
That's
Steven
exactly
Soderbergh
who I was
doing
say.
A kid's
as soon as you
movie.
Said, if we're going to attach a director.
This totally is Steven Ocean's Soderbergh's 11. Take on like Stranger Things. That is what this is.
No, I would say it's his kid's take on Ocean's 11 or something. Or yeah, what's the other one he just recently did? The race car one.
Race cars and stuff. My name is
Logan Lucky.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't
totally.
Know.
So now that you read it, Rodrigo, you said you're glad you read it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it good? I mean, is it as good as Matthew and I are excited about, or is this just like, oh, settle down, guys? There's a lot of problems with this book.
No, I mean, I really don't feel that there are any problems with this book. I think that there are things in this book that are, like uncomfortable. And I think there are things in this book that, you know, certainly kids shouldn't be doing. But I think those are all there by design. I think the author is trying to convey a feeling and themes, and it all seems to work really well. I think there are times, you know, as I was reading it, I was like, how are they going to finish this?
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. it's a bunch of kids. And it's like, are they going to shoot down a bunch of kids here at the end? And the ending is good enough. I wasn't unsatisfied with the ending.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely this is one of those things where like the action of it, the excitement of it is not the big twist at the end mm-hmm. or anything like that. It's kind of this journey as we start ratcheting up the drama, solving the mystery, and also the characters kind of go back and forth and eventually make up their minds to do something really insane.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Ridiculously insane. But the thing that's really great about it is so many times when you have a story featuring children, the creators will soft pedal things and it'll all turn out to it'll all have been okay. And it's a Rugrats episode. And this is a book that features these characters making really stupid decisions with really big ramifications and consequences. And it does not cheat us on that. And that, I think, is phenomenal. The fact that they're willing to, you know, to take these adult consequences and these things that are clearly going to happen. Something bad is going to happen, you guys. And they don't soft pedal it just because our protagonist is, you know, an 11-year-old girl. They they go through with it. They accept that this is the reality of our situation. This is how this world works. And basically, it's kind of a hyper reality, real world sort of thing with maybe a little bit of Hollywood built in. And that's fine. You know, that's a perfectly legitimate way to go. But the fact that this story is being told the way it is, and it gets to the end, and you get that ending,
yeah,
and they make it work. Rodrigo talked about having to kind of cheat a little bit on that last issue's opening sequence.
Right.
That actually is the one to me that justifies the previous four or five, because that's the one where you're like, okay, I know what this is, and you don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And when it is clear what it is, that is possibly the most heartbreaking bit in the entire thing, especially that moment where Berger is like, I didn't even know my mom's car could fly. That should not be a heartbreaking sentence. That is not something that should fill me with dread and existential angst and make me want to go check on my child. But it does in the context of this story. And I think that is the real strength of this storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You said Berger is the worst. Berger is the worst. And you still love him. You still like this terrible little hyperactive, completely obnoxious, in no way self-aware, terrible little kid. He and his friends don't even necessarily, I mean, it's that friend thing where you always have that one friend who's terrible, and don't either of you say a damn word on this show. You always have that one friend who's terrible.
We have to say stuff.
No, you
Otherwise,
don't.
Otherwise, it's an hour and a half of silence.
I think there's a point in our lives during which we've all been Berger.
True.
Yeah, true.
Some of us more than others.
There's another character that I'm, and this is the thing that I kind of dig about this. Is it's not something that is talked about. It's not something that is that the creators make a big deal about. And the cool thing is with like someone like my son, my oldest son, who's around the same age as the characters in this book, it is very everyday, very normal, and very okay. There is a character who is not cis normative in here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It doesn't come out to say whether he's, homosexual or transgender or anything like that. He's definitely not a cis character, and nobody makes any kind of a big deal about it. It's never only brought up, and the only reason why a reader is aware of it is because of this character's actions in the book.
Right. Because of decisions that he makes.
Right. And it's really nice. Yeah. Really handled really well. And I like that. And when I talk to my son about, or even if he brings it up, he's like, yeah, so what? Big deal. That's the way that person is. And that's okay. And I'm like, cool. That gives me hope for, future generations. And even though this book is really dark, there's a lot of hope in this book as well.
Yeah. And I think that the darkness is in service of telling a story. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, it's not necessarily allegorical. That's not the word I'm looking for. But it's a story about being that age where you are not an adult and you're not a child anymore. And you're in that thing of I'm putting together my adult brain. And sometimes you're grabbing bits and pieces of personas and sticking them in there and doing things that clearly aren't going to work. But that's all in here. And I love the fact that none of it is treated for cheap jokes,
Right.
None of the humor, even when we're making fun of Berger being terrible, and they do, you're not making fun of Berger, the character. You're not making fun of Berger for being an awkward kid. You're not making fun of Berger for being the weird Jewish kid. You're not making fun of Berger for, being in a single parent home. It's not cruel, but they are, in fact, making fun of Berger, and he is the worst.
Yeah. I also really dig the art style in this, especially when it comes to layouts and how they do interesting panel breaks. Like there's an interesting one where Paige is talking to her dad. He's putting her to bed, and the bedroom, you're seeing this from the top down. In the bedroom, you see overhead, and that basically comprises the entire panel. But then it shows you the doorway and I think either a bathroom or a hallway outside. There's nothing
it's like the blueprint of her room.
Yeah, there's nothing going on outside, but yet they're creating a separate panel just by the way that room is divided up. And they do that multiple times in this book, which I really, really like how it's done. There's when they're breaking into the turd's house and they're doing like this 3/4 cutaway view of everything that's going on in the house, including something that looks like in the basement, Frankenstein making out with a wolfman or something that's going on.
I believe that is somebody watching porn.
Okay, because it looks
if you
like
look at that basement thing,
yeah,
it's like a guy looking at a screen.
Oh, okay.
So I'm guessing that's Turd's dad watching some monster gay porn.
Because it's definitely not Frankenstein making out with a wolf man in a traditional making out kind of sense.
No, it's straight up. It's gay porn.
Yeah. And I had to watch that again. I had to look at it again. I was like, okay, what's going on in this? I mean, I know what it looks like, but is that what it really is? Monster porn, ladies and gentlemen, the internet is amazing.
Well, and the thing that's really great is if you take bits of this out of context, it sounds so horrible.
Yeah.
But having read it, you know, because there's a point where she's hiding and there's a guy coming back to his house and they've broken into his house and she's sitting there and she happened to find this guy's switchblade.
Well,
and
Burger Burger. It was the tall kid. Stretch. Right,
Stretch found the switchblade, but she has it.
Right.
And the little devil on her shoulder is like, stab him in the junk. And I'm like, what?
He's going to find you, stab him in the junk. And instead she just lights the guy on fire, which in turn burns the whole house down. So.
Well, like you do.
Yeah. Anyway.
Sometimes, and that's another thing. Sometimes you have a great idea when you're a kid that doesn't work out and has terrible consequences. And not necessarily to the point of, you know, burning down your neighbor's houses. Although I'm not saying I know somebody whose nephew accidentally burned down a house recently. I'm not saying I don't. I'm just saying that I do. And that's that moment where you're like, again, weird kid stuff, kind of encyclopedia Brown shenanigans up to a point. And then you realize real world consequences come into play.
If I had to have one negative comment about this book, it has to do with Walter. Walter is a very soft-spoken kid.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to convey his soft-spokenness,
a tiny dialogue,
they make his dialogue super, super, super tiny. And
yeah.
I'm sorry, but even trying to blow that up on our screen, because we've got an electronic review copy from Black Mass Studios, I couldn't read it. And if I were to make one suggestion, that's my only critique, is if you could just make his stuff just a little bit larger, it would be easier to read and might help us understand Walter a little bit better. But I think the idea that, you know, he's soft spoken, so we have to make his stuff really hard to read. I mean, I understand it, but couldn't read it, unfortunately.
I read it at 150%. And I got to tell you, there are times where you don't understand what he's saying, or you can only read part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, I feel like that's really successful.
Yeah, especially if he's quite mumbling.
Yeah. I mean, that is an example of using the comic book medium to do something that you wouldn't have to do if you were doing this as a television show or a movie, but using it so effectively and making it all work in a way that maybe it shouldn't have.
Maybe.
And yet it did.
Yeah. So this book works fantastic using the medium. The story is really aided by the fact that this is comic book. This is visual storytelling. This is very, very good. Question, should this be a movie? Rodrigo.
I mean, I think as long as they came up with a good way of representing some of this stuff, it definitely could be a movie.
Or even a Netflix original series or something.
Sure. I think there's a lot of movie influences already in this. If you get the trade, I think you'll be able to see like 8 dozen movie style covers that were made for this. So, you know, all of its movie influences are there and they're already ready to hook onto something else. So I think this absolutely could be a movie.
Matthews.
Or a miniseries.
I'm afraid no. And the reason why is because these kids are 12. And I don't know that anybody would have the wherewithal and the guts and, frankly, the ability to edit that it would take to take real 12-year-old kids and tell this story. I feel like aging them up too much would actually kind of blunt the story being told. Because, again, in a lot of ways, this is kind of a coming-of-age story, even though that age is really low.
They could still be 12.
I guess. I mean, yeah, I still haven't watched Stranger Things, but I understand that those kids are kids who curse and do things and have stuff happen to them. But
well, and even if you watch a show like what we see, we were talking in the pre-show about AP Bio, those kids, at least most of the main ones, are already in their 20s, borderline 30s on at least one of them.
I suppose, you know, Chloe, what's her face, was like 11 or 12 when she was murdering people in the first Kick-Ass movie. So,
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the you guys ever watched The Middle?
The Middle. No.
Yeah.
It's a sitcom. Like, Sue from The Middle. Like, I think when that show started, she was already in her 20s and she plays like a 14-year-old.
So the next question, bottom line for this book is, Rodrigo, final thoughts and final recommendation.
This book is really not something that I would have picked up on my own. I guess I picked up the first issue on my own and then I was like, cool, thanks. And then didn't follow up on it. But if you are into heists, if you want to see sort of really offbeat storytelling and a very thorough application of like the comic book medium into a story, because this piece does a lot with comics as a narrative medium, I would definitely recommend this. But just know that it's a dark story and dark things happen.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, final thoughts.
I think that if you can really approach this as what it is, and that is, you know, an almost cinematic story with bits and pieces and stuff that you have, you know, from your movies, from your old school films and your weird stuff with your Gene Hackman and all of that crazy stuff. But also the fact that we are looking at this and saying these are actually children on the cusp of becoming teenagers. And you can put that together in your head and not be off put by the fact that our main character is a girl who nearly kills someone with a gun. I think that that's fine. I think that it's great. I really appreciate, I love nearly every panel of this book. And I feel like even where it felt like there was a misstep, they corrected it in such a way that it felt like they meant to do that. And I really appreciate that in a story.
The book was not what I expected it to be. I expected it to go in one direction and be a very different story than what this was. So I was pleasantly surprised by how this book came out. I am pleasantly surprised at how good this book is. And I would highly recommend anyone who wants to get into some dark comedy, pick up this book, Four Kids Walk Into a Bank. It's superbly well done. It is executed almost perfectly. The art style is fantastic, and you get to hear kids be kids and do things that kids do, including walk into a bank and rob it for $4,500, which is like
and
a lot of money.
Endlessly.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, everybody. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of the Major Spoilers experience.
As always, here at Major Spoilers, we love your feedback. We want to hear what you have to say, so make sure to hit the comments section at Major Spoilers and share your thoughts and reactions to this and every episode.
Or even better, send us an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com.
And don't forget, you can support this show and everything we do by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
We'll be back next week because we know that you love comics and we do too. We'll see you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. Defeat the Man of Steel. I'm gonna rearrange your face if you continue to debate whether Logan's claws could pierce Steve Rogers' shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. And I don't care if Spider-Man's a clone.
This podcast is copyright 2018 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.